A pizza delivery man walked into a bank in broad daylight with a bomb strapped around his neck, demanding money. Had he acted alone, or was he actually a victim of a bigger crime? That crime is now the subject of a new Netflix series that explores a complicated plot that seems too strange, too twisted to be true, but it is.
The Netflix docuseries takes us all back almost 15 years to the crime that captivated the country. The narrator, Trey Borzalieri, is a Western New York native.
I was in Buffalo, New York, which is just east of Erie, on that day, August 28, 2003.
Admittedly, he became obsessed with the pizza bomber case. He calls this woman, Marjorie Deal Armstrong, the mastermind. Or as the title suggests, an evil genius. For 10 years, Trey communicated with her in prison through letters and hundreds of phone calls.
I was very uncomfortable with it. I was, from the start, but I was willing to do it, for the story and to get truth in this case.
And to get to the truth about Wells himself. Prosecutors and investigators argued he was part of the planning and not an innocent hostage. The series argues otherwise.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is...
Laura Richards, former criminal behavioral analyst, New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zambetti, the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where I cast killers, psychopaths, victims, anything in between. We have a very special podcast today.
Yes, our listeners are going to be very, very happy because we have two very special guests.
Trey Borzalieri, co-director and executive producer of Evil Genius.
And I'm Barbara Schroeder, the writer and director of Evil Genius, the true story of America's most diabolical bank heist, streaming on Netflix as we speak.
You hear that, guys? We have the filmmakers from Evil
Genius
freaking studio. It took so long to get you here. You guys are like beyond busy. We know that.
So we're so excited to have you here. You guys are rock stars. You're very in demand. And we've got questions for you. And our listeners have got tons of questions for you.
Great. And can we just say thank you for having us? Because your podcast is probably my favorite podcast. I know Trey's listening
to
it.
Wow, are you serious?
Yes. It's great to be here because you guys add, I think you add an extra level of expertise that makes it really fun to listen to as, people like Trey and I who are into this world and this is our genre. So very respectful of your work and thank you for having us.
Well, thank you for saying that. That's amazing.
Well, thank you so much, Barbara and Trey, for coming. We're so, so honored that you listen to our podcast and we're so happy to have you on because we always love to give the listeners that extra advantage. So we try to go behind the scenes and really figure out what's happening in these cases. And of course, we focus on the victim. And I think that was one of the very good parts about your show, because you did actually bring him back to life, give him a voice.
Right. Second chance at justice as Trey. That was his goal to start out with, I think, one of them.
Yeah, and it's such, just even listening to the four episodes of your podcast, it really is furthering the conversation about Brian Wells and his culpability. So, I would imagine we'll kind of get into that a little bit today.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Sure. We certainly find that so often the victims become a footnote in their own murder, and in their own case. So we try and restore the narrative. But, of course, in this case, there's a lot of controversy about whether he was a victim or whether he was actually had some involvement. So we definitely have some questions. Some of our listeners have emailed us as well, wanting us to ask you those questions, because obviously you were in this for 10 years, Trey, which is a long chunk of time. And then what appears on screen, it kind of gets distilled down, doesn't it? So I'm sure there's plenty of other information that I would definitely like to hear about, as would our listeners.
Absolutely. And Barbara has given 5 years of her life into this case as well. So, you'll get a good amount of insight from us.
Quick story. When Trey first came to me 5 years ago, I thought, we can put this story together. It'll take a year. We'll solve it. No problem. And 5 years later, and a lot of citizen journalism on Trey's part and, experienced journalism on my part, we worked together. And I think, the fact that we have a confession in part four that the FBI was unable to secure was, I thought, pretty astonishing that Trey was able to make that happen.
It was, definitely. And I was a FBI profiler when the case happened, and I did consult on the case. And I retired, though, at the end of 2009, so I didn't know anything that happened after that. So I was really, really excited to see those episodes of the show because it really filled in so many of the questions that we had had are now answered thanks to your work.
How did you first become involved, Trey? You know, what happened? And then at which point did you reach out to Barbara? Can you just give us a little bit of the background?
Sure. So, yeah, so for me, it was, you know, once I saw that first documentary on the West Memphis 3 case.
And that's Joe Berlinger.
Joe Berlinger, yep, and Bruce Sinofsky. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw that in college and I was blown away by it. And it was, you know, for the first time as an audience member, you know, I was looking at a documentary that was, you know, I was having a reaction to it like you would a thriller, you know, like you were seeing Seven or, you know, one of these thrillers. And
you're kind of participating in it.
Yeah, and there's
a way,
this,
it's drawing you
get
in.
To play detective.
It's drawing you in, and you're trying to, you know, you're given this opportunity to kind of come to your own conclusions if it's given, you know, if the story is objective. And so I was looking for many years for a story, a crime case that, you know, I could try to do something like it with. And lo and behold, you know, my personal life and this case sort of dovetailed. And when once I heard about it, I was actually in my hometown. I was right on Lake Erie the day that this happened on August 28, 2003. And I saw the video footage, the news footage of, you know, what had happened and that this perpetrator had used a live bomb to do this crime and then was killed in the process. So in essence, he blew himself up. And I thought to myself, oh my God, how desperate did this man be to have to do this? And it, you know, a couple days later, it started to trickle out that there was evidence that, you know, showed that someone had put him up to this and
right.
that this wasn't his own doing. And once I heard about that, I was, you know, even more compelled because I thought, what a disrespect of life here. How could something like this happen? And I wanted to get to the bottom of it.
So what happened? You drove to
Erie, started, Pennsylvania? You know, making early phone calls to all the reporters that were covering the case. I started collecting all the articles online. You know, I was utterly blown away 3 weeks later when there's a body in a freezer and the house is right next to this dirt road leading to the TV tower where Brian Wells made his last delivery. And then I come to learn that the FBI is saying that these cases are not connected. The other pizza delivery man, Robert Panetti, had died, you know, prior to them finding the body in the freezer. So, you know, the case was just growing and it was becoming more and more compelling. And then, you know, once the FBI said that the two cases were not connected, I was shocked, but I looked at it as an opportunity. I was like, if I could get Bill Rothstein to do an interview, this will be, you know, really fascinating because if he's not connected, he's going to want to speak. You know, he's going to want to come out from under the suspicions. Mm-hmm. And this could be somebody that would, you know, really participate. And so,
Were you just door knocking at this stage? I mean, were you literally just doing house to house, knocking on doors?
Literally, if I was in Erie and if someone walked down the street, you know, by themselves and they were near me, I'd walk up and say, hey, what do you think about this Brian Wells case? And so I just started documenting from that point of view because I had never done it before. But I was so, there was so much going on in Erie at that time. You know, there was a real fear factor that, you know, unless you were there when I was there, you don't know about it. And they were being told by the FBI that this could happen again. And so people were afraid. And, you know, people weren't even comfortable, you know, by any means talking about it. So everything about making this documentary was difficult. And I think, you know, hopefully the proof is in the pudding because I think you can kind of feel that in seeing it all come together.
But, Jim, why would the FBI say that this could happen again? I mean, what – this seems like it could never happen again. I mean –
Well, it is, as we said in the podcast, this is the first time in law enforcement history a case like this has occurred. There's nothing that happened like it before or since. And those kinds of cases that stand out like that, those kind of one-off, really bizarre cases, they confound a lot of people. And I don't think that the particular FBI agent who was sort of leading the office there really understood what this case was. And when you start looking at it, as we talked about, the complexity of this case, like, was as great as the effectiveness was bad. So it's clearly somebody who thought they were smart, but had no criminal sophistication. and so no criminal experience. They thought they were smarter than everybody else, so they did all this bizarre stuff. Well, everybody knows the more simple a plan is, the more easy it is to carry out. And I don't think they really had done an investigation at that point and really just made, you know, made a fool of themselves by making that statement.
There was also this added layer of the FBI agent who was on the street and then his bosses who weren't on the street. So there were directives coming from up above saying, look, you may think it's this guy, but we don't, because he passed Bill Rothstein, the, you know, one of the prospective masterminds, he passed a lie detector test, and so did his roommate. And let's focus on, you know, another suspect, another lead. So there was some interdepartmental drama within the FBI as well, even though I think some of the investigators, the agents, thought they knew who it was. They were directed into another onto another avenue.
And terrorism was a part of this, you know, initially, too, because, you know, this is, as you guys have said, I believe in your podcast, that this is the wake of 9/11 still. And so, you know, law enforcement was reacting a certain way. And you know, from what I've read and from people that I've spoken to, you know, when this initially happened, you know, there was a great idea that this was done in a form of, you know, as terrorism.
And that's what people were scared of.
And that's why they thought that it could
maybe
be
maybe there'll
repeated.
Be another bank robbery, maybe they'll, you know,
that's so at that moment. What was the general kind of like the community intel as you were, you know, just stopping, you know, we call it like the Clapham omnibus, you talk to the man on the bus of just, you know, give me your reaction. What was the general kind of reaction from
people? It was very interesting. Many people, you know, were as shocked as I was, and as Jim just described, you know, the fact that they moved away from Rothstein. Because the more that they heard about his character in the local news, the more they read those articles, you know, they're like, wow, this is really, this has to be the guy. And then the FBI profiles start coming out. And when you start reading those, it's like to a T, like this is Bill Rothstein. Like how could they not, you know, why would you move away from him, especially with this profile? And so many people were repeating that, like, you know, this is a crazy case, but it's so crazy. And we know this crazy man, Bill Rothstein, it's got to be him. And then other people were, you know, they were perplexed. You know, they didn't know what to believe. You know, people initially thought that, you know, Wells perhaps was involved, but then they thought he wasn't. And then there was like, they were running three scenarios, you know, could it have been him by himself? Could it have been him and someone else? Or could it have been, you know, a greater conspiracy?
Oh, the question I had was, from your perspective, how do you feel the FBI handled this case? And did you see any opportunities for, oh, they should have done?
Well, I think we should start even before that, to the initial police response. I believe that they treated this as if it were sort of a hoax. They kept their distance, but they didn't at all look at the possibility that they could have a victim sitting in front of them with a bomb around his neck. And Brian Wells literally was murdered right in front of their eyes. I think they could have done a number of things that would have protected his life. Putting bulletproof vests underneath the device, putting one over his face so he wouldn't get blown up. I mean, they could have done something to protect him. And then once it did happen that it actually blew up, I think they should have immediately brought in more experienced law enforcement. But at the point that the FBI got involved, I believe that the administration in the FBI kind of took to a grandstanding position before they had actually conducted a thorough investigation. They made conclusory statements that, in fact, turned out to be very wrong. So I have to say I'm embarrassed at how that was conducted, because it was not the proper way to conduct an investigation. Unless they were involved in some sort of a media strategy to try to lower the defenses of the actual perpetrators by saying, hey, you got away with it, this is totally unrelated to anything else, because they were focusing on those people. But in fact, I don't believe they were doing that. And I don't believe that they had an overall strategy. I think that it was a mistake. And it's actually professionally embarrassing to see that kind of behavior on the part of the FBI. We should be, above all, very professional. That didn't happen in this case.
Good insight. Interdepartmental drama.
when Trey first brought the story to me, I was so impressed because he's like a citizen journalist. And I'm a seasoned journalist. And he said, hey, I've got this story. And I'm like, I remember that story. It was about a guy with a collarbone, whatever happened. And he started telling me, and every moment was like, wait, what?
So a question for you guys then. I mean, in terms of deciding about the footage of Brian Wells, of what you put in it and what you didn't, of course, you kind of pixelated, you know, certain parts. Yeah. What was your decision-making
that
process?
Was very strategic. From the get-go, we didn't want to use that image, the images, the video of Brian's explosion, the full image. But we also strategically, and we sat in the edit room for an hour, the editor and myself, and he said, oh, take it to this frame. I'm like, no, pull it back. That's too far. He says, okay. And we really thought about this because we wanted to use it to reinforce the heinousness of this crime and how someone was publicly executed and no one was ever charged with his murder.
Right.
So a lot of people think they see the full explosion, but you don't.
Right.
We cut to black and you hear the rest of it. So whatever, you know, tricks the mind plays. And then at the end, we've been asked often about why did you choose to use it again at the end? And we did use one image from Brian's, you know, what happened to him, because, again, it was to reinforce, look at all, you've seen everything. You've seen these people get away with things. You've seen, you know, no murder charges filed. We still don't know who wrote the notes. We still don't know who decided to make the bomb live. And this person died.
Right. And remind us of what this is all about. Yeah.
Seems like a, you know, codicil to them.
I love that. I really applaud you for that. You know, we've seen other documentaries that, you know, Jim and Laura have really objected really strongly, West Memphis 3 being one of them, of the footage used. Yeah. But I went and I looked up some interviews of you, and I knew that there must have been way more graphic footage that you could have shown, and probably the news did at the time. You know, but you were very, I felt like you were really responsible.
Here's some insider information. A lot of people think that, I mean, the live news cameras were at the scene when this happened.
Sure.
But at the exact moment of the explosion, there was a technical error back at the TV station that was broadcasting live. So Brian's death was not broadcast live.
Oh,
for those,
wow.
What was it, Trey, 7 seconds or something like
they
that?
Yep, they lost audio.
Isn't that, so that's like a gift from the.
Shuffling to try to figure it out.
Wow.
Yeah,
right.
So at least that wasn't broadcast.
Yeah, right. That's amazing. So it just suddenly cut and.
Yes, and then came back on.
They went off because they lost their audio, and so they were never able to get it back. And by the time that had happened, it had exploded.
When I watched the footage, I mean, I wasn't here when that case happened, and you know, so I didn't know really what to expect. And I've got to say, I really was shocked by it. And so, you know, the decision to put that in obviously does talk to the fact of just how he was executed. I mean, you kind of rub your eyes and you don't know whether what you just saw really happened. And then when you put it in the cold light of day, that people need to understand that's what went on, to understand the type of crime we're talking about here.
Absolutely. It's just so horrific. And at the time, it was really unique footage because, you know, it was the beginning of a new digital era. And that footage in that moment was absolutely shocking. It had leaked, and they turned it into you know, like one of these emails, like a viral email.
Right.
There was no YouTube, and so it spread, and people would open up an email that was addressed maybe Pizza Bomb or Pizza Delivery, and
gross.
They would open it, and then that would quickly play. And
my goodness. I mean, macabre. People are really obsessed with the macabre, aren't they?
Also, a little insider information that hasn't been broadcast. It's not probably a big deal, but we were really intrigued that we dug for a long time, and we found dash cam footage. The dash cam footage you see in there, that was apparently one of the first. This was back in 2003. This was one of the first units that had a dash cam.
Mm.
So this, where you see them taking Brian down and putting the handcuffs on him and going up to cut his T-shirt open to see if it was really a bomb. That's the first time that was ever broadcast. So
by showing the people what actually happened, the violence of that action, you also showed what happened right before. And to me, behaviorally, that's the greatest indicator that Brian did not know what was about to happen to him, because although he did, when it started beeping, he did sort of ramp up a little bit in terms of his, quote, urgency. It's very difficult for me to even say there was any urgency in his voice. And I don't believe he knew he was about to die. I believe he was probably, if he was fully aware that was actually a bomb that was about to kill him, I think he would have freaked out. He would have done anything he could. He would have stood up. He would have done anything to try to get out of it. And He didn't do that. And that tells me he was duped, at least to a certain extent.
Yeah, a lot of people ask, why was it that Brian was saying the things that he said while he was sitting there? Why did he say black men had put this on? And why didn't he just reveal, hey, it was Marjorie Dale Armstrong and Ken Barnes and Bill Rothstein? But he was following a script. And the fact that he was following a script led us to believe that he still had hope that he could live, that it wasn't real. Right. Otherwise, he would have at the last moment. Even though his affect, Brian's affect, was one of being, you know, a good boy, a good employee, he wasn't demonstrative, and mm-hmm. he would just follow the rules. But still, at that last moment, you think someone would have come forward and said...
I mean, his demeanor, just to me, it just struck me he thought it was a game. I mean, the nonchalance that he shows by picking up the lollipop, you know, those kind of behaviors, he is just so calm about what's happening, you know, that there's no panic that I could observe from him.
Yeah, I mean, I think really... You know, and this is like one of the deeper sections, obviously, you know, of the case and the debate and the conversation and the parlor game. But, you know, going through these moments, you know, to me, just that it just seems like there is still a lot of misinformation. Maybe, you know, we jump to conclude. It's really interesting for me to see people view it and then, you know, try to comment on it and sort of follow in these same sort of pitfalls that are there for the case from the beginning. If we look at him, you know, for him, and from my point of view, after reading everything and seeing everything, you know, this is somebody that was clearly trying to survive. And it was a very complicated situation. By the time he gets into that bank, you know, there was a soundbite that was great. There was a little interview that you had at the beginning of one of your episodes. It was, I think, an older man who was in the bank online with him. You know, there's a lot of in the media and the commentary on this, you know, we jump to him being nonchalant in the bank. But, you know, if even just going to that witness, he got in line and was only in line for a second. And then he jumped to the front of the line and went directly to the next teller that was available. So there was urgency there that somehow, you know, we're left with, you know, Brian Wells is walking out of the bank like Charlie Chaplin swinging his cane, you know, and I think that comes from some of the commentary that's, you know, been established in this case from certain individuals, certain investigators who are of opinions. Mm-hmm. And I think if anything else, you know, or if nothing else, you know, what the documentary can do is sort of bring us back to the start to reevaluate the behavior in here. And you know, it's still of my opinion that there is a lot of misinterpretation. If you
well, another possible interpretation of him with the lollipop is something we see when somebody's under stress in an interrogation. I mean, salivation decreases, and it could be that he was under stress and he did that because he was trying to lubricate his mouth because he was so dry. But obviously, we didn't have sound. We weren't there. We only got little snippets in the documentary and the news coverage. So we didn't really get to see his entire behavior during that time period. But, you know, it's just when we do get to see it and at the critical moment, he just doesn't evince any indication that he actually knows he's about to die. He may seem a little nervous and he may be trying to convince them to let him go, but he's not at all thinking this will blow up and kill me. And that's just, I think, the greatest behavioral indicator, because if he knew his life was almost over and he still just sat there and was compliant, there must be something other really overriding that, because everybody has an instinct to live.
Jim, do you think that Brian Wells was totally innocent? And I'd like to ask you guys too.
I believe that, you know, one of the statements that Marjorie said was that it's not like we didn't measure his neck for the collar. I believe that he probably was in on it, but he thought it was fake. They told him it was fake, and he had no idea that it was actually going to blow him up and kill him.
Well, I believe, you know, very similarly, because of, you know, the behavior, the little things that we did see, and I do take your point, Trey, we didn't see everything. But, you know, the fact that he was sort of almost childlike in his effect, and he loved these kind of scavenger hunts and the whole kind of game part, that it clearly was a game. And, he, you know, there was an element where he was probably enjoying some of it, but not ever thinking his life would end as a consequence of it. When you look at his face, when you look at what's going on in his eyes, as much as you can from the distance, your instinct is to survive, and therefore that lack of, oh my God, this is really happening, it just didn't cross his mind until much later on. And, you know, that would have been a blink of the eye, you know, once he realized he's playing the game.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree as a layperson that he did not just show up, deliver a pizza, and become a victim. I mean, I think to some extent he was part of something, and he probably didn't know really what he was a part of, and he was probably manipulated very well.
And coerced.
And maybe on paper or in the still of the night when you're talking about this plan, it seems like it will, you know, won't be as difficult as it turns out to be in real life. So yeah. I would agree with Jim and Laura.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, great debate, and a lot of the opinions, you know, are not just here, you know, coming from you guys. I mean, these are shared opinions. A lot of people share these same exact opinions. I just find it to be so fascinating just, in one aspect of it, like the game idea. You know, when people gravitate to learn, you know, they learn that he also liked games. The scavenger hunt is something that was done in the local Erie Times News newspaper. And so the whole city, in essence, participated in what we're
for
calling
years. They called them the Great Key Hunts. Yeah.
And so Brian Wells participating in that, you know, is this connection that we have to him liking games. So it's the same connection that, you know, the majority, perhaps, of the 300,000 people that live in Erie are participating in.
It's part of their culture.
So it's the context is different.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's, if anything, it's almost like, you know, that's a great tell that whoever did this was local. Because,
right.
You know, they're aware of this. Yeah. But it's so fascinating to me to think that someone would enjoy participating in something like this because they participated in this local town scavenger hunt, you know, and I've had, you know, veteran reporters in Erie share that same thing. Like they shared oh my God, Brian Wells probably woke up this day and he felt like James Bond because he was going to do this scavenger hunt for the bank robbery. And I'm like, is this like, it sounds absurd.
Well, it reminds me of this. If you've ever heard of it, it's called the Hidden Mickey Theory. Have you ever heard of this?
Mm-mm. No.
An old friend of mine, investigator that I really admire and respect, he had a theory. Like, he was like one of these old grizzled detectives, like, every case has a hidden Mickey. And meaning, in Disney, hidden Mickeys in Disneyland, they hide Mickeys, and then you can go and look for them.
Right.
And
okay.
One of them will be, like, a prize. So the hidden Mickey in this case, for me, that speaks to Brian Wells's innocence more than it does his complicity, is the fact that when Brian came out to that tower site, that remote tower site, and was delivering his two sausage and pepperoni pizzas, he put the pizzas on the hood of the car, and then he waited to be paid. If you know you're part of a bank robbery, and you know you're not going back to work at the end of the day, you're not going to wait to be paid. So that, to me, that lends itself towards the
argument.
But
why do you say
innocent.
He waited to be paid? Who?
Well, that's, yeah, where did you get that information?
From Ken Barnes.
Yeah. And that's
slipped.
In the documentary.
He slipped and also admitted that there was no day before activity. There was no day before planning.
But Jim, do you think that we need to believe Ken Barnes?
Well, I mean, you know, Ken does tell the story later, but he may tell it in a way that is more beneficial to him. You know, what I can't understand in this whole thing is why nobody was charged with felony murder. Even if the prosecution thought that he was, that Brian was very much involved in this, it's still a felony murder. When somebody's killed in the course of the commission of a felony, that's a serious crime. And many times felony murders can lead to the death penalty. But they treated it as if it was a non-murder because they felt that Brian was involved. And I just don't understand that.
Right. And they were of the belief that he was involved, so they felt that they couldn't place those charges against anybody. But if you take that out of the equation, if you take Brian's innocence out of the equation, and then it is a murder case. And so were these people all in their, you know, bizarre hoarding weirdness, were they all little evil geniuses by accident because they managed to outplay the FBI and the state police and... You know,
and remind authorities. Me, did somebody get charged for James Roden's murder too? I can't remember.
Marjorie finally confessed. Yeah,
right.
She kept trying to blame it on Bill for the longest time, and then when she was up against the wall, her only option was to confess and play the crazy card, as her fellow inmates said. Yeah, she manipulated the system.
Mm-hmm. should be charged with the murder of Brian Wells and a lot of other charges, and he had a fugitive from justice, a rapist that I turned into the FBI in his house for 2 years.
He says you committed the murder.
Rothstein is a filthy liar. Rothstein is trying to rape me, but he's not going to get away with it.
No, she clearly had issues with mania, and many times people do their best thinking, obviously, when they're manic. I mean, their brain is operating at hyper speeds, and the problem with it is that they lose touch with reality. And I think a number of things that she did, as well as what Bill Rothstein did, for example, being seen at the gas station by the UPS driver when the call was being made to order those pizzas. I mean, what a bonehead mistake. I mean, to do something like that in a public place, I mean, it shows you the serious lack of criminal sophistication here. And so to be, quote, so smart, to be such a genius and do something so boneheaded, it just makes no sense. However, like you said, they still managed to evade prosecution. They were never prosecuted for it. So, you know, was that genius? I don't know.
We should say, for people that think we used the title to say these people were all evil geniuses, that wasn't where it came from. It's the fact that they'd all protested too much, and Marjorie Dill Armstrong literally in one of her rants said, "I'm no evil genius." I'm like, "Oh, that's a good title."
Yeah, that's great.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because obviously her face is on all of the kind of marketing material, etc. Yeah. And obviously she was very beautiful when she was younger. And so I have two sort of questions. One is, why did you decide to hone in on her and not call it like evil geniuses, because there are co-conspirators here? And the second part to that is, what did you learn about her and her fall from grace, you know, from the point where she was beautiful and talented and seemed to have everything going for her? Where did it start to go wrong, and why do you think that was, from what you've learned behind the scenes?
Yeah, well, I'll start with the second question, then you do the first question, Trey. But Marjorie Dill Armstrong was very smart, very intelligent. She was beautiful when she was young, growing up. Guys were mesmerized by her. And it was when she was 23 years old when she finally realized, something is wrong with me. And I think her brain was working at such a high speed, and her parents, they noticed something was wrong with her, but they were like, "Oh, you'll be fine. Here's some money. Here's some, you know, we'll take care of you." So she was, I think, mollycoddled a lot whenever she did have an issue. So at 23, she's finally like, "Wait, I can't get in a good relationship with a guy. I blow things up. What's wrong with her?" pun not intended. You know, what's wrong with me? Meaning she blows up her relationship. She said in one of her therapy reports that she wasn't able to make connections with people. So that is the only moment that I ever felt sorry for Marjorie Dill Armstrong. She's a wicked woman. But in that moment, I thought she knew something was wrong. She went to the doctor. She said, "Help me." And that's when she fell off the cliff, and we never saw that old Marjorie again. Mm-hmm. And then she became very tricky and devious and manipulative and hard, you know, and look at what she did to Trey in the 10 years that he talked to her. She badgered him, verbally assaulted him, and she did that to everybody. But yet she is, as one, there was a writer for Pop Sugar who said she is revoltingly magnetic.
Yes. And Barbara, did you ever meet her?
I didn't. I wrote to her a few times. Trey was the one who met her in person in prison.
Can you just talk about that very first time you met her? Because sometimes people like this that I have in my life, they are magnetic, and they just there's an air yeah. about them yeah. that lights up, for better or worse. And yeah, can you talk about that?
Yeah, she was, you know, all of what you described. I mean, you're sort of, when I was, you know, with her for the first time in person, you know, so obviously sort of pinching myself. Because I was, you know, well aware of her history and her connection with the case. But there was, you know, almost like a childlike quality to her as well, where, you know, she would laugh and sort of carry on as if, you know, it was, you know, a young girl or a young lady when, you know, but everything around her was so dark. And she was just in, you know, this permanent bad mood and reacting to every little thing, trying to manipulate, you know, every situation, you know, even if it's, you know, in the visiting rooms of these prisons, you know, where she would sit or who was around her, or who was looking at her, who was listening. You know, she took issue with all of that. You know, when it came to, let's go to the vending machine, how is she going to dominate the vending machine? I mean, she would go through more food you know, in a compulsive way, you know, when we were together. I mean, it's shocking. I mean, it would look like a grocery list.
Like what kind of things?
We only had, you know, available what was in the machines, but, you know, full on chicken sandwiches, pizzas, you know, multiple candy bars, multiple sodas, you know, anything she could get, and she would just consume because, you know, it was like the one day she got to eat that stuff. But you could tell it was, you know, way more than anybody would, you know, would normally do. One thing about her is she's so impulsive. And she was impulsive to the point where she would say and do things even though she was well aware that it would be detrimental to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a switch went in her and she didn't care.
No filter.
Self-sabotage.
Yes.
So, Trey, I think you used, if I heard correctly, you used the word compulsive and impulsive sort of to describe her. So those are actually two opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of behavior. So I just want to go into that a little bit more. So obviously, the sort of hoarding type behavior of many of these people that are involved, I mean, that's kind of compulsive. That shows a compulsive nature. They just, you know, they just can't help themselves. But impulsivity is basically not thinking but acting, just acting, you know, and changing mind and moving from one thing to the next and just bouncing all over the place. So are you saying that she had both of those components to her personality? If so, that's a really, really disturbed person. That's somebody that really has issues and must be difficult to be around for any period of time.
Oh my God. You know, I'll go back to the personal aspect of it, of my relationship with her in a second, but it's a great opportunity. You know, what you had led with, in the case she's seen up at the gas station, at the Shell station, you know, an eyewitness put her there next to Rothstein when he made the call for the pizzas. You know, that would fall into that category of impulsive. You know, if she knew what was going on, it's so, you know, it was the hardest, it was the thing that I would go back to her time and time again. I would be like, you know, if you were involved in this, how could you possibly have stood next to him at that telephone? And, you know, I must have said that to her 100 times. And, you know, her answer obviously was canned in that, oh, I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know he was doing that. I've stood next to him a million times and him ordering a pizza. What's the big deal? But, you know, getting deeper into it, the fact that, you know, if she, you know, obviously she was a part of that plan that day and she wanted to execute it and it didn't matter. She wasn't thinking.
Control.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She wanted control. She wanted to be there and make sure it happened the way she wanted it.
There's also this element to her, and somebody who is in the psychology field described it to me. They said psychopaths feed on empaths. So, and I think a lot of people have responded to us and said, God, I know somebody who's kind of like Marjorie, like in, you know, an ex-girlfriend or an ex-boyfriend. And it's fascinating that how she would latch on to people. Like, and Trey is an ultimate empath. He's like one of the nicest people I know. Also dogged to get to the truth. But, and I think she fed on, you know, she did that to people in her manic, in her manic way, compulsive, you know, impulsive way.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, classic behavior. And the things around, you know, maybe some of the strategic things that she can see her vision, but the tactical stuff, like the here and now, you know, the two things kind of collide and conflict because she can't quite plan the things and control every aspect of it, which she's trying to do. And I wondered if you could walk us back just to when you first started your sort of conversations with her and what that was like. Was it you were writing first of all, and at what point did you decide to go and see her? And then just describe what that was like sitting down with her for the first time on a personal basis, if you can.
And just before that, I just want to acknowledge that I'm sure there was a feeding frenzy around this story at first, right, when all this went down. But then after the news cycle, you kept going.
Yeah.
And
forgive me for interrupting, but the FBI couldn't get in to talk to her. She was off limits, and Trey was talking to her.
Right.
So, you know, how really, I'll have to say this again because it's a great quote for it, is, you know, necessity is mother of invention. And for this, you know, it was strategic in the sense I didn't want to go into Erie that first month or two because there was so much attention.
Mm-hmm.
So I was talking to the reporters at the Erie Times News, and I said, you know, when, you know, I called in October, I called in November. And at the end of November, they said, you know, everybody's out and it's quieting down. It's a good time. So I gathered everything together and, you know, pushed off for Erie in February of 2004. And And it was really met with, you know, anybody that would talk to me was supportive. And what I was doing was I was documenting sort of the experience, trying to get any information, find people, and just come from it in a real big picture way. Literally, I would ask, how did this case affect you? Mm. And that was how I conducted interviews all the way through. You know, what typically would be a 15-minute interview in this business, you know, for me was an hour and a half. I mean, these just long interviews talking about everything. And so finally, you know, there was no information. I mean, there was a gag order for law enforcement. They couldn't speak on the case because it was such a big case. And I wasn't local, so I didn't have, you know, a local detective that I was friends with that I could call. And so by 2005, it looked to me like Marjorie must have some insight on Bill Rothstein. After I went to his house and experienced what I did there, he felt guilty to me. It felt like he was front and center in this case. And so I reached out to her, you know, just sort of like, you know, do you know anything about the Brian Wells case? And that was where, you know, it was a classic setup in essence that, you know, I was an empath because I wanted to hear everything about the case. But it was a professional relationship. You know, it was, I'm not, you know, I had borders and guidelines and things that, you know, there was an edge that I wasn't going to go over with her. And, you know, all these years later, you know, there's this just massive amount of, you know, phone conversations, letters, all of her stuff that, you know, once Jessica comes forward in the end, you know, of the piece, for me, it sort of ties it all together. Because I say that because literally from in the very first conversations with her, she was talking about Jessica, forecasting about Jessica. Jessica was clearly on her mind the whole time.
Top of her mind, which is very telling.
And Jessica was the sex worker slash Brian's favorite prostitute who makes a big reveal at the end in part four, just in case people didn't
remember. So I reference that. So it's like, you know, in the body of all of this information that I've collected on Marjorie and our relationship, you know, for me, the story that you see in the series, you know, there's many layers to all that information that's there. And, you know, by being able to have this sort of, you know, this long-term relationship, I could really go through and corroborate things that she had said through all the years and, you know, ferret out the truth there. And so that's why, you know, for me, I'm of the opinion, I believe what Jessica said. My opinions about Brian Wells evolved just like everyone else. In the beginning, I thought he was guilty. You know, in the first visit that I made to spend time with his landlady and landlord, I walked away from that thinking, wow, this man did this. This is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And so, but having been able to spend the time with it and evolve, you know, my opinions changed.
Well, Trey and Barbara, this has been really fascinating. And everything that you're saying is really, really interesting. We have so much more to ask you. And so we're going to have to ask you to come back so we can continue this conversation. Thank you for being here. And thank you to our listeners. And until next time, signing off on Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.